Okay. Any questions from the class? You once said that you were going to ask me questions about time-dependent perturbation theory.
But I have not had time to formulate those.
Yes.
Maybe it's going to be tomorrow. Because that's when I plan on doing all of my homework.
Yeah. Okay, so partial wave expansion. So most of this class has been interested in bound states. So last chapter, we're dealing with scattering states. And a perfect way of solving the problem is partial wave expansion. It seems to be a big pain because you have to find these phase shifts, conceivably for an infinite number of angular momenta. Which sounds difficult. It's not too bad if you're at low enough energy, because then the centrifugal barrier keeps the wave functions from experiencing the potential, and so the phase shifts are going to be zero. But particularly at higher energy, it becomes basically literally an infinite task. So last time what we talked about is kind of some qualitative features, mathematical features of the solutions that we've been talking about for a couple of lectures. So we saw qualitatively, and I had an argument why it was the case that these phase shifts for k going to zero approached n times pi, basically having the tangent being zero. And we worked out what the equation was for the tangent of delta, where gamma was the so-called logarithmic derivative evaluated where the potential, the new potential, went to zero. And we argued that for small k, the numerator goes to zero, the denominator goes to infinity, and so tangent delta has to be zero, which means that the deltas have to go to n pi. Argument is good, unless we happen to have a zero in the denominator. That situation is called zero energy resonance, and obviously it's fairly rare to have exactly that situation. We looked at kind of what that meant qualitatively. If we look at the U version of the wave function, so that's the capital R version divided by R, the capital R version times R, what we discovered was that, and of course, U satisfies exactly the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, so that's kind of why we're dealing with it. If we look at the behavior of U up to the matching point, if we look at the slope at this point and extrapolate it back, then where it intersects the r-axis, that's the corresponding scattering length. So in this version here, A is less than zero because the intersection is to the left of the origin. And in this version here, the potential is stronger, so we've gotten enough curvature, and now we have a positive value of the scattering length. And obviously, as I make the potential stronger and stronger, you know, I can get all sorts of possibilities. The zero energy resonance corresponds to where the slope is exactly zero at the matching point, which is obviously a rare but possible occurrence. And at that point, we switch from a negative infinite scattering length to a positive infinite scattering length. And so all around the vicinity of a zero energy resonance, we're going to have a pretty large scattering. And it is important to remember that the scattering length is pretty dissociated from the physical potential, right? It deals with this kind of mathematical intersection, and so the potential can be small and we can still have a huge scattering length, and vice versa, all sorts of possibilities. No particular relationship between A and what you might call the physical size of the scatterer. Turns out that if we take the next order term in this Taylor series expansion for cotangent of delta zero, so-called effective range, that can be connected to the physical size of the potential. And we can use this formula then to get a formula which is pretty accurate for example, NP scattering for low values of K. We also looked at the phenomena where we zoom between these values of n pi, so right at the midpoint where the phase shift is equal to pi over 2. That's where we get a particularly big contribution to these cross sections. If we Taylor series expand that in energy, we end up with a formula for the contribution to the total cross section in the vicinity of that resonance, having what's called the Breit-Wigner or Lorentzian shape. We prove the optical theorem. Imaginary part of the scattering amplitude is related to the total scattering cross section. And it's important to remember that even though the scattering partial wave expansion isn't particularly useful at high energy, it's still true at high energy. And this theorem, which required it, is also true always. So it's not limited to the range where the partial wave expansion is useful. It should be true under all circumstances. We looked at kind of qualitatively what happens with an attractive potential. It's going to suck in phase, so delta goes to positive values. Repulsive potential is going to kind of move the wave function out, corresponds to negative phase shifts. Questions?
So on this sheet, I wrote something down yesterday, which I think is wrong. We have the subscript numbers, those correspond to L?
Yes.
Okay, so what I have written down is wrong.
What did you write down?
Something about Taylor series expansions.
Yeah, so what we did do is we Taylor series expanded delta zero because it's the one that's going to contribute at low energy. And we did it, for a while ago, we did it with just the first order term, the scattering length, and then we added another term to it last time. Okay. That's all we're doing. And we could take more terms, but as a matter of fact, if you're going to have more terms, it turns out that at about that time you would usually also want to add some L's. So that's mostly where it's useful. Other questions? Well, so although partial wave expansion is true for any energy, we said it's not super useful for high energy, so it'd be nice to have something that worked at high energy, and that's going to be the Born approximation. Born? Yeah, it is just Born. And while I said the Born approximation is true for high energy, a kind of a better statement is that it's true when the wave function is not much changed by the potential. And at high energy, whether there's a potential there or not doesn't change the wavelength inside the potential region, and so it's particularly good at high energy. But if for some reason the wave function is little changed by the potential, then the Born approximation would also be true. And the Born approximation, like any of these, the Born approximation basically doesn't make sense unless there's an infinite series, right? Because 5 is an approximation for a million, you know, if you have enough terms. So we can take the Born approximation to lots more terms and do well under any old circumstance. But as is usually the case, one gets tired and one quits at the first or second available non-zero term. Okay, but before we can talk about the Born approximation, we've got some stuff to talk about. And the first bit of stuff comes from the complex variables course that you didn't take. And there is one hugely useful result of that course that sometimes called the Cauchy residue theorem or just the residue theorem, and it has to do with integration. So if we integrate between a and b, z is a kind of the generic variable for complex numbers. So here's the picture. Here's a complex number. Here's b, a complex number. And I could integrate along some path. And it turns out that just as for a conservative force, the work doesn't depend on the path, turns out that that's the case for complex variables. This doesn't depend on path. And that has the same consequence it had for potential energy. That is to say, that means that if we go around in a circle, we better get zero. But there's some important provisos here. But what happens if there is a singularity enclosed? And in that case, it works kind of like Gauss's law. So for Gauss's law, the surface integral gave us the enclosed total point charges. If there were dipoles in there, they didn't count. If there were quadrupoles in there, they didn't count. We only counted the point charges. And that's pretty much how this works. The only singularities that are going to contribute are going to be singularities of a particular type that are called poles. And that's where the function can be approximated just as something like that. So for example, if I have a singularity that is that squared, that integral is still going to give us zero. Corresponds basically to a dipole, and Gauss's law still doesn't count dipoles. So what the residue theorem says is this integral is equal to 2 pi I times the sum of the residues. And what the residue is it's the coefficient that sits in front of the 1 over z minus z naught. And we only sum the residues that are inside of the enclosed surface. So this is an incredibly useful way of evaluating integrals that you would otherwise not be able to evaluate. So if you look at a table of integrals, there's usually a bunch of so-called definite integrals in the back, and those definite integrals are not calculated by finding an antiderivative. They're very commonly calculated by this residue theorem. Okay, so that's one bit of stuff that you had no particular reason to know, but is extremely useful in all sorts of mathematical physics. The other thing we have run into before, but you might have forgotten it from E&M, and that's Green's functions. So back in E&M, we were interested in solving Poisson's equation, where the Laplacian of the voltage was equal to the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And it was easy to solve this basically because we could solve the corresponding problem with a point charge. So let me call this corresponding solution G for Green's function. And obviously it depends on space, and it also depends on where I put my point charge. So with Green's functions, I can solve this function pretty simply. It has to be the integral of rho of r naught divided by epsilon naught, the Green's function, and if you're unsure about that, just take the Laplacian of it, right? So if I take the minus Laplacian of this, this thing is going to generate a delta function, and when I do the integral, I'm going to get exactly what I want. So I don't know if we used exactly these words, because the Green's function was something that was pretty straightforward. It was basically a point charge. And so probably what we said is we were just adding up the charge due to the point charges. But this whole process can be made more general. So Green's function is anything that solves a differential equation kind of with a delta function. If Matt and Tyler were here, I could remind them about what they're doing in mechanics, which I think, and I think you used a different book, so I'm not sure you did this exact thing. We're solving things like damped harmonic oscillators, and the free problem is pretty easy to solve. The driven problem is pretty easy to solve. The impulse problem is not that hard to solve, where you hit it with a hammer. And one of the surprising results is you can solve, for example, the driven harmonic oscillator as a sum of hammer blows. Did you do that at all?
I think we sort of skipped over that part.
Could be. In any case, it's exactly the same thing. The hammer blow solution is a delta function, and we can solve then a general problem where we have a general forcing function, you know, some amplitude cosine of omega t or something like that. We can solve the general problem just by putting it in. So Green's functions are good ways of solving differential equations. They don't seem to make it into books that mathematicians use to solve differential equations, which I don't know if they were in your book, but they weren't in my book. And I fundamentally don't understand that. Well, it probably has to do with delta functions. Mathematicians aren't too happy with delta functions, although they can be made mathematically happy. Okay, so with all that, let's see what the plan is. So we want to solve Schrodinger's equation, and just to make Schrodinger's equation look like Laplace's equation, let me multiply everything through by 2m over h bar squared. Right? So if I do that, typically what I'm going to get is minus the Laplacian, and then I'm going to have 2m the potential divided by h bar squared. All of this times psi wants to equal e psi. Well, e psi times 2m over h bar squared. And typically we called the energy h bar squared k squared over 2m. So this is k squared psi squared. And if I put the Laplacian on the other side of the equation, I've got that. And my plan is to solve this equation where I've got a delta function, and then I can just put together those delta functions to solve the problem of interest. So let me call the solution to this differential equation g of r naught. Then it has to be that psi is equal to the integral of 2mv divided by h squared times psi. All of these evaluated at the source point of the delta function. And then my Green's function. And then integrating over all of those sources. Right? Because now when this thing is called Helmholtz equation, when the Helmholtz operator hits psi, it hits g, it produces a delta function. When I evaluate that delta function, I get just what I want. Sounds good. It's a little bit unhappy, you may have noticed, because it's not actually a solution. Right? It's something that says that psi is equal to psi. I have to know psi in order to calculate psi. That doesn't sound perfect. But we'll be able to iterate that. Take that solution, plug it in again, take that solution, plug it in again, and we'll be able to make a series that is going to be our solution. And maybe the other thing I should remind you about is just as with differential equations from mechanics, there are also solutions where k squared, and let me call this free, equals zero. So I could add such a, solution, and it would be, you know, it would be perfectly good. Okay, so we're on track. So the plan then is to try and solve this differential equation where I have a Laplacian plus k squared operating on this function g gives me a delta function at the point r0. And again, this, all these things are operating on the r. The r0 we're thinking of basically as being, at least for the time being, a constant. And we're going to add up over all of those solutions, just like we did all the time in E and M. Okay. So, I don't know, solving differential equations, particularly partial differential equations, is not necessarily pleasant, and a good trick is to use Fourier transforms. So I'm going to say, let G, oh, so the first thing I'm going to do actually is switch origin. Right, so wherever this point source is, let me move the origin to that location. So now this is just the delta function of r, and I can switch it back at some future time. So what I'm looking for then is the Helmholtz operator giving me delta of r. And I don't know if you remember, but we had a formula for the delta function. Oops, this wants to be d3r. So that's basically the Fourier transform of 1. That turns out to be a delta function. If you want to kind of qualitatively understand it, if r isn't 0, we're adding up waves of all possible amplitude and they're going to cancel. If r is equal to 0, then we're adding up an infinite number of 1s and we're going to get infinity. So turns out, and we did actually do this last semester, turns out that's a perfectly good formula for a delta function. And let me do basically the same thing to g. So let me say that g is equal to the Fourier transform of lowercase g . And the advantage of this is that the Laplacian acts very nicely on that quantity, right? All it does is bring down an ik. The two pi's are going to cancel, so what I have here is an algebraic equation. Okay, so I see I've done everything in a standard way, but it leads to a degenerate notation. So instead of calling this variable k, I'm going to call it s. And the reason I'm doing that is I already have a k. And maybe it would seem easier to change that k to something else. But okay, so with that proviso, now when these derivatives hit this r, it's going to bring down a minus s squared, and I have k squared g of s wants to equal 1. So I have now a formula for the Fourier transform of capital G, namely 1 over s squared plus k squared. And all I have to do now is to take that g and plug it back in here to get the corresponding capital G. Okay, so apparently capital G is equal to 1 over 2 pi cubed integral of 1 over minus s squared plus k squared e to the I s dot r integrate over all space of S. Okay, so all we have to do is a triple integral. Notice that this thing just depends on s squared, and so it's spherically symmetric in terms of s. So it kind of makes good sense to think about doing this integral in spherical coordinates in S space, in which case this would be S squared ds d cosine theta d phi. Well, I mean, S is a totally different space from physical space. What am I going to choose for my z axis? Well, the logical choice to choose is going to be in the direction of r. Right, because if I choose that simple direction for my coordinates in S space, then this is just S times the magnitude of R times the cosine of the angle between them. Okay, so we're supposed to integrate over all of S space. And what we choose our S coordinates, it's up for grabs. It has nothing to do with physical space. And I'm going to choose my Z axis of my S space in the direction, whatever the current direction is of R. In which case, the dot product of S dot R is just going to be SR cosine theta. With that choice, it's azimuthally symmetric. So the integral d phi is just going to give me 2 pi. And the d cosine integral is easy because it's just e to the I rc. So what I've got then is cancellation of one of those 2 pi's. I still have all of this. And I've still got this. But now I have 1 over ISR e to the IRSC evaluated from minus 1 to 1 for cosine theta going between minus 1 and 1. And of course, I still have the S integral where S is going radially from 0 to infinity. Okay, well, this, particularly if I put in a 2, it's going to look a lot like sine, right? Because if I take this stuff, what I've got is 1 over 2 I e to the IRS minus e to the minus IRS. And that combination is equal to sine of RS. Okay, so let's see what we got. We got this 2. This R doesn't care about S, so it can come outside. And then we've got S squared over minus S squared plus K squared sine of RS all over S dS. And the important factoid is that this is the integrand is even, right? Sine by itself is odd, but one of those s's cancels. So, and of course, s squared by itself is even. So we can double the range of integration and use up this 2. So this is 1 over 2 pi squared 1 over r integral now from minus infinity to infinity of s divided by minus s squared plus k squared sine rs ds. And having put these things together to give a sine, we're now going to take them apart. So we did that in order to double the range of integration, but now we're going to undo this again. So this is e to the I RS minus e to the minus RS divided by 2i. Okay. So I guess let's rewrite what we've got. We've got g of r, and really this is r minus r naught that's in there because we switched our origin. We've got a 1 over 2 pi squared, got a 1 over r. Now we have a 1 over 2i that comes from the sine, and we've got an integral from minus infinity to infinity of s minus s squared plus k squared, and we've got e to the I rs minus e to the minus I rs. All of that integrated ds. I think that's what we got. Okay, so where does this contour integral come in? Well, if we look at the function we've got here, so this could be written as minus s plus k times s minus k, where k, you remember, is a fixed constant. S is what we're integrating over. So this has poles right at k and minus k. And currently, we're integrating right down the line. Well, integrating right through a pole is singular, so I'm going to avoid it. And there are lots of ways to avoid it, and they all work basically equally well with an asterisk. So we'll come back to this, but I'm going to go like that, I think. Yep, I'm going to go like that. And I'm going to do these two integrals separately. I'm going to do this integral, and then I'm going to do that integral, and then I'm going to put the pieces together. And it'll be kind of clear why, I hope, in a second. So let's take a look at the first integral. So this nice Cauchy residue theorem, it required a closed loop in order to be present. And if you think about it, I am free to close that loop like that at infinity, because there s is going to pick up a term that is plus I times something infinitely big, and so I'm going to get e to the minus infinitely big. So this contour at infinity contributes nothing. So this integral then has to be equal to 2 pi I times the sum of the residues. And this is the only residue that's included. So I have to have the residue at s equals plus k. Okay, and the residue due to s equals plus k is this term here. So what's the kind of constant that's sitting out in front? Well, so the constant that's sitting out in front is going to be, well, put in s is equal to k. Yeah, put in s is equal to k. So I've got s there, and I've got minus 2k there, and I've got e to the I r k there. Do notice that this I that we pulled out is going to nicely cancel that I there eventually, so don't worry a whole lot about that. Just for the record, what would have happened if I had included this guy? So if I had included that guy where s is equal to minus k, then I would get here e to the minus ikr. And that would correspond, it would be a perfectly good Green's function, but it would correspond to waves that were coming in from infinity as opposed to going out from infinity. So this choice, the purpose of it is to choose only waves that are outgoing. The others are perfectly good choices, but they're going to produce incoming waves, which is not what we want for scattering. Okay, how about the other term? Well, I can't close up here because there, if S is equal to plus I epsilon as it is up here, then I'm going to get minus I times I, I'm going to get plus. So all bets are off. But if I close the other way, I can do that integral. And if I do that, now the other one is the one that's enclosed. Now there's a little proviso, another extra minus sign that it is, I hope, is reasonably clear. When I said the loop integral of f of z was equal to 2 pi I times the residue, I hope it's clear that if I integrate this way, I get the opposite result than if I integrate that way. So this theorem has assumed that I'm integrating in the normal way, right, the anti-clockwise way, where I'm not integrating in the normal way here. I'm going anti-clockwise. So there's going to be an extra minus sign, which might as well just take care of this minus sign, I guess. Okay, so what we've got here is then, with this double minus sign, 2 pi I times the residue at s equals minus k. So at s equals minus k, this is the, that's the polar term. If I put in s equals minus k, I'm going to get minus k divided by plus 2k, minus, and I'm going to get e to the, with this minus sign, irk. So this is also going to be minus 1/2 e to the I kr. So obviously these things come together to give us minus e to the I kr. And let's put together the rest of the pieces that we have. We have this overall 2 pi I. The I goes away, and I can knock down one of these two pi's. So what I'm left over with then is 1 over 4 pi, this 2 and those 2 pi's, 1 over r, and minus e to the I kr. And of course, really what we have is that the Green's function for an arbitrary delta function is 1 over 4 pi, now we put the minus sign there, I guess, 1 over the magnitude of r minus r naught e to the I kr. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Remember that for just for Poisson's equation, where we didn't have that extra term, the Green's function was that. So by having that plus k squared, all we did is add something that was propagating. Oh, I guess I lied a little bit, right? So this is also r minus r naught. Okay, so in some sense we're done, right? We've now shown that a solution to our scattering problem is that psi is equal to some free solution. It could have always been present. And then we have plus the Green's function, but we got this minus sign here. So we've got minus 2m over h bar squared, integrate over the potential, the wave function, and then we've got our Green's function, e to the I k magnitude of r minus r naught divided by 4 pi magnitude of r minus r naught integrated over all of r naught space. Okay, so for us, this free solution, we're free to choose it anything we want, but we want something that is traveling up, we typically wanted something that's traveling up the z-axis, so I'm going to have that guy be that. And it's going to turn out to be useful to actually think about this as a dot product so that we could be going in any old direction, right? So my initial k vector is just in the z direction, but at least for the time being, let's just sometimes think about that as in that sort of form. And I think I told you that the plan is kind of to iterate this. That is to say, this is a perfectly true equation as it stands, but because it's of the form psi equals psi, it's not super helpful. But if the wave function isn't much changed, and that's the approximation, then I can also do the same thing here. The initial wave function is pretty much the same as the in the interaction region is pretty much the unperturbed wave function. And as I said, if I wanted to, I could iterate this process just fine. But we're not going to. Now remember that we want to get this in the form of e to the I kz times some f of theta e to the I kr divided by r, right? Where this is the outgoing spherical wave, this is the incoming wave, and f of theta is the scattering amplitude that tells us the differential scattering cross section. So I'd like to see how this solution can be the kind of standard form. And the starting point for that is to take a look at the magnitude of r minus r naught. So remember we're integrating over this potential. And here we're trying to figure out what the wave function is at some point r. And r naught is confined to where the potential is non-zero. So it makes pretty good sense to do some sort of expansion of the magnitude of r minus r naught. And we actually did this exact same thing in E and M. Let's take a look at the square, which is just the dot product. So that's going to be r squared minus 2r dot r naught plus r naught squared. And if I pull out, I'm going to call this r naught squared small. I'm going to neglect that. So I've got then r squared 1 minus 2r dot r naught divided by r squared. And I really wanted the square root of this, right? So the magnitude of r minus r naught is about equal to r. And if I take the square root of 1 minus x, it's about equal to 1 minus half of x. So this is r times 1 minus r dot R naught divided by R squared. Okay, which is R hat dotted into R naught. Now here there's kind of a little bit of a tricky approximation. If we're actually at some, you know, basically infinitely far distance, this term is way over going to dominate the R naught term, right? So R naught might be a Fermi and R might be a meter. So there's a factor of 10 to the 15th between those two quantities. But we can't get rid of that term always because if the wavelength is comparable to R naught, we can be adding in 2 pi's to that exponential. So while we can neglect something that's of order 10 to the minus 15th in the denominator, we can't neglect it in the numerator. So we have to hang on to it there. Okay, so let's see what we got, because we've come a long way. So this term, which we're hoping is going to be of the form f of theta e to the I kr over r, what we've got it currently as is minus, I can take care of that too, I guess. It's m over 2 pi h bar squared, the integral of v naught. And for psi, we're going to write it as e to the I k initial dot r naught, right? Because that's what we're supposed to, where we're supposed to be evaluating it. This is all over what's basically r. So let me pull out the r. And what I have left over is e to the I r minus r hat r naught period. And this is all integrating with respect to r naught. Okay, as far as the r naught integral is concerned, this thing is a constant, so it can come outside of the integral. And then we've got exactly what we wanted to, right? We've got these terms. So everything else has to be the scattering amplitude. So f has to be minus m over 2 pi h bar squared integral of e to the I, the initial k dot r naught minus, and if we think about it, so the overall scattering experiment is, here's our scattering experiment, here's our detector that's at some location that we're trying to define, the r hat direction. So if something has gone this way, it must have a k vector that is equal to k times r hat. Or if you want, just take this as a definition, that the final value of k is k times r hat. So then this is just k final dotted into r hat. And then all of this is multiplied by v0. So the picture is the flux is coming in the initial k vector, and we're looking for scattering that would require some final k vector. And what we've got here is k initial minus k final dotted with r naught. So this k initial minus k final, it's sometimes called the momentum transfer q. Okay, so what's left inside the integral is just the Fourier transform. The Fourier transform is defined to be the same thing. So this is the Fourier transform of V naught evaluated at the momentum transfer. So So to find F, all we really need to do is to take the Fourier transform of the potential and then evaluate it at the momentum transfer. It might be useful to remember where the angle is now. So in this picture, we've got a final K and we've got an initial K. And we're interested in what's happening at that angle theta. This momentum transfer, just do the math, in terms of its magnitude, it's 2 times the magnitude of either one of these k's, right? There's only so much momentum, times the sine of theta over 2. Okay, so let's, in the remaining minute, get a wrong answer. If we think about the low energy limit, k goes to 0, this term is 0, and so we just get the volume integral of the potential. And the volume integral of the potential, it's going to depend on the size of the potential. It's, for example, going to be a real quantity. And none of those are good, right? Because we know that, in fact, at low energy, we have all of this complicated behavior. We've got resonances. We've got cross-sections that are huge compared to the physical size. We also have the optical theorem, which says that the imaginary part of F gives us the total cross-section. But this F is real at k goes to 0. So this is not working for low values of k. But who cares? We didn't really expect it to work at low values of k. And in terms of resonances, for example, the one thing we know for sure in our standard picture of a resonance, right, the wave function is hugely modified when I'm inside the potential at resonance. And therefore, my assumption that the wave function was not hugely modified is certainly false. So all the low energy phenomena we saw with partial wave expansion, none of that are we going to see with the Born approximation. It gives us a simple and wrong answer when k goes to 0, but we don't intend to apply it. Right? We intend to apply it for large k. One of the nice things is it turns out it gives us the right answer for Rutherford scattering. And that's really pretty surprising. Why should it give us the right answer for Rutherford scattering if it doesn't give us, at any old energy, if it doesn't give us the right answer for a square well? And basically the reason, I think, is because of the simple functional form. So if you remember the functional form, now this is actually sine of theta over 2 to the fourth, but it doesn't matter. Energy just occurred as an overall factor. So if it works at high energy, the same functional form has to work at low energy. Right? So even though we have no expectation to believe the Born approximation at low energy, as a matter of fact, it gives us the right answer for Rutherford scattering for any old energy. And incidentally, you can kind of see how it's going to work, right? In the Born approximation, everything depended on sine over 2, and here we've got this sine over 2 in the answer. So, and I don't know, maybe we'll do that, maybe not next time. It turns out the easier, so there is the usual problem of infinite scattering for the Rutherford scattering cross-section. So the usual way to handle this is not, I should probably shouldn't go there, not to handle literally Coulomb scattering, but to handle Coulomb scattering that has a term that gets small at large distances, and then take the limit as lambda goes to 0. So you make it have finite cross-section, and then the limit lambda goes to zero actually exists just fine, and then you get the Coulomb scattering. Okay, so. Much fun was had. So we'll be doing course evaluations Friday.